Welcome to Volume 2 in the series, South Pender Pioneer Families, with Kelly Irving and Ruth Warren. This series is dedicated to learning about the unique and important history of South Pender Pioneer Families and their connection to Stais, South Pender Island, and the surrounding Salish Sea. Siblings, Kelly and Ruth, two descendants of the original Pender settler family, will share stories about their family connection to Pender. They will both speak about summer visits to South Pender when they were children, and having a 14-year age gap between them, provide insight as to the differences of their individual childhood experiences on the island. They will share some of the memories they have of many of their extended family, including Anne and Lynn Henshaw. As well, Kelly will read a poem written in the 1880s by their great-grandfather, Arthur Spalding, titled The Hermit. That and so much more. This recording was made in January 2024 at my home on North Pender Island, and is made possible with grants administered by the South Pender Historical Society. I am your host, Chris Walkluck, and it is my pleasure to present this series to you. My voice has been extracted from this final audio in order to give maximum time and clarity to the interviewees to communicate and share their stories. Thank you for listening. Now here is Kelly and Ruth sharing the Irving family story.
I'm Kelly Irving. I'm a fourth generation Pender Islander. My great-grandfather was Arthur Spalding and married Lilia Spalding. They had several children, and my grandmother was my Granny B, Beatrice Spalding, and my father was her son, Wyman Bruce Irving, who is commonly known as Kelly Irving. My dad grew up on Pender, and my mom was from Sterna, and they met one another as children, but then remet when my mom was working Port Alberni and my dad was there logging. So sometime around then they met. And yeah, so our family history goes back to Arthur on the island. And he came to the island in 1886 and had the farm in the South Pender Island Valley. And shortly after he came, I believe 3-4 years later, he married Lilius, who at that time was living in Victoria. And her father was Joseph William Mackay. So her maiden name was Lilius Mackay. And her father was a Métis fur trader with the Hudson's Bay Company. And he came out to the coast when he was probably around 14, 15 years old, worked at Fort Vancouver, and then he worked on ships. And then when they drew the border, he had to move to Victoria, Fort Victoria. And he had befriended James Douglas, who was the chief factor, the Hudson's Bay Company at Fort Victoria. They were both Métis. Maybe that was how they became friends. I'm not sure. But he worked in Fort Victoria for years, traveled up and down the coast. He had a talent for linguistics and had a family, several daughters. Moved around BC a lot. He was in Yale during the Gold Rush. He was up north. There is a book written about him, a fellow from Nanaimo. Greg Fraser wrote a book about him a few years ago. The subtitle is A Métis Business Leader in Colonial British Columbia, which is a bit humorous because my dad always told me that he was a failed businessman. He started lots of little businesses, but none of them really worked out. Anyway, his daughter married my great-grandfather, and they farmed on South Pender, and eventually her sisters moved up from, they were living in California, and they moved to the valley also and lived in the valley. So my father's side, the family was centered in the valley on South Pender. My dad grew up there. My grandmother and grandfather, my grandfather was from Victoria, Bruce Irving, and they divorced when my dad was probably around 11 or 12, and my dad spent a lot of time with his grandfather. His grandfather and grandmother basically became his parents for a number of years, and I take it that from what I've heard from my dad, that Arthur Spaulding and my dad and my dad's cousin, Art Pender, were all very close. And Grandfather Spaulding wrote stories and poems to entertain the kids, you know, pre-television, pre-radio. And I have copies of some of those, and the family has copies of those. And they're quite fun. They're full of fun poetry, funny little stories, sketches. Yeah, and great-grandfather Arthur Spaulding. I don't know, we talk about the Spaulding family legacy on the island, and everybody has a different version, I guess. He was a farmer. He was an artist. He was a poet. And I think what I and my father, I think, draw from that was the family history and his talents as an artist. And David Spaulding, my dad's cousin, David Spaulding, wrote a book a few years ago called Put That Damn Matic Away. And I think Arthur got tired of farming after a number of years. And that's why the name of the book, Put That Damn Matic Away, he just got tired of the hard labor of farming. And especially during the Depression, it would have been really tough for the family, and he was getting older. But I think he really enjoyed his grandchildren and great-grandchildren and the family life on the island. And I think we all benefited from that the island connection. And my sister Ruth would have been a little more familiar than I with that, because she remembers great-granny, and I don't. She had passed away by the time I was born.
Yeah, I'd like to add that Mum was a pain from Saturna when she met Dad, and they used to go back and forth between the islands when they were young. And Grandfather and Dad, Kelly Irving, would work on the farm during the war. Art Pender went off to war. Dad stayed home to work on the farm in the valley with Gramps Spaulding, and then Dad joined the BC police eventually.
We both grew up with a father who was a policeman. When Ruth was young, he was BC police. When I was young, by the time I was born, the RCMP took over from the BC police, so my memories are always of Dad as RCMP.
And Dad was BC police because Granddad Bruce Irving, Granny B's husband, was BC police after he was in the First and Second War. And then when he came back, he joined the BC police. And then Dad eventually went into it.
And we're kind of fortunate. Well, we are fortunate in that our dad wrote his memoirs down, which are great reading, because he talks about his childhood on Pender, what it was like growing up in the valley and around Bedwell Harbor. And he was born in 1914. And so he worked on the farm as a kid, you know, growing up on the farm. I think he felt a little awkward with me as a child because I had a totally different life than he had. You know, he grew up with animals and harvests and that sort of yearly cycle, whereas I grew up in a very suburban environment. And he would talk about and joke about, you know, the horses and the cows and having to get up to milk and what kind of life that was. He really didn't want to have a farm himself, I think, as he got older. It wasn't a lifestyle. I think he got tired of that, getting up at 5 or 6 in the morning to milk the cow. And him being a policeman, and we were moving around a lot. So, you know, I didn't grow up on Pender. I didn't come to Pender until probably as around 5 or 6. And Ruth and I were talking about this because I couldn't even remember. I had reoccurring dreams of when I was in my 20s and 30s of what I realized was driving from Kelowna to the coast, driving through the hills and early memories of Vancouver, urban environment. But I probably really didn't come to Pender until I was 5 or 6. And then we were living in Victoria for a number of years, 3-4 years. And we had come to the island quite a bit. And at that time, the ferry was at Port Washington. And so it was a long drive from Port Washington to Gowland Point. And I remember it used to take so long to get to the cabin, because my dad built the cabin down Gowland Point, down from my grandmother's house. It takes so long to get there, and then it was so great being there. Ruth would probably remember the cabin being built.
That was 1949. And we were living in Maple Ridge at the time, Haney. And we would come over on the CPR boat from Steveston or Vancouver into Port Wash or Bidwell Harbor. And it was a log cabin, and Herb Spalding helped with it, and Jeff Jennings, Uncle Jeff. And we had a porch off of the cabin where we had the wash basin, and that was a very popular spot because we could hear the whales coming around Gowland Point. And early in the morning, you would hear the hissing and flapping, slapping on the water. And my memories of the summers that we came to Pender, to South Pender Island, we were able to run free. We were either on the water, rowing a boat down Tilly Point or over to Little Bay. That was a long row. And walking down to Bedwell Harbor. We didn't have a car at the time, a family car. So we were walking all the time, or up on the Golden Mountain. And Jeff and Hope Jennings had goats and sheep and a cow and horses. So that was great for Rob and I. I was 14 years older than Kelly, so we had the free run at that time, and spent many years up until probably 55 at the cabin on South Pender every summer. We got to know the old house that was on Gowland Point that Parkins had lived in, Tessie and Jerry Parkin, and Granny Spalding was over in the valley still, and Teases were in the valley farming, and Higgs, Granny Higgs, I think, was over in Higgs Bay, and that was a very early memory, or maybe it was one of her offspring. But we were busy all the time on the water or running around and just home for meals, and it was a great life. And then, the big occasion was boat day. Everybody would go down to the wharf at Bedwell Harbor. And the post office was on the wharf at the time, a very small shack that Granny Spalding was the postmistress, and people would come down and collect their mail. It wasn't delivered around the island at that time. And there was a freight shed on the wharf where the sheep would be. Uncle Jeff Jennings would come down the wharf hill with his tractor and a trailer full of sheep. And I can remember standing in the trailer, probably with Joe and Jan and Rob, and climbing up the side of the trailer, hoping the sheep wouldn't pee on us. But it was quite the hill to come down. It was dusty, gravel, and a few years later, Jeff did have an accident going off the side of the road as he was going between Bedwell and Johnny's Field, which was the name of the bay where Jennings lived at that time. So we had lots of excitement with the Jennings family and in their vehicles, in their trailer, tractor. And Camp Bay, I mentioned that before. Camp Bay was our swimming hole. It was warmer water at Camp Bay, and also there were slices, or we called them caves at the time, in the bluffs on the west side of Camp Bay that we thought were quite mysterious. And then our picnics so often were at the canal, where Uncle Herb and Dad would be checking for artifacts, which Dad found many. And right up until the 80s, when Simon Fraser came over for an archaeological dig, Dad ended up contributing quite a few of those artifacts to the museum on North Pender. And when her Uncle Herb and Aunt Wynn Spaulding came to Pender, they had a small cabin from a logging camp up the coast that they put ashore at the canal. And I think that was the first time I met them, and that must have been in the late 40s, but I'm not sure. But anyway, we were very, very fortunate. And the only car I can remember on the island at that time was Mrs. Craddock, who always had California plates on her car. And I don't know if she ever went down to California, but Jan Jennings and I often joke about that. And at that time, if people came off the ferry with Alberta plates, well, that was a no-no. Why are they coming here? We don't need visitors here from out of off the coast. And another thing that really intrigued us during the end of the war, there's an island off of Washington State called Skipjack. They used to bomb a little rocky island next to this island, and we could see the plumes going up from when they were bombing. We'd see the plane come in and then this plume of smoke. Yeah.
Yeah, so my memories of the cabin, a little different because I was so much younger. We would drive all the way from Port Wash to the cabin and then we'd just be there. We didn't go anywhere else, which in later years always struck me as so funny. I'd spend all my time either on the beach in front of the cabin, which is now the cabin is on Trolley Dunn's property, and it's still there. She had the foundations redone and some work done on it, so it's stabilized. And I spent all my time on the beach, very little time at my Aunt Hope's, which was just over the hill. It wasn't until I was a teenager, probably, that I wandered around there with Barb Pender. I remember one day we went exploring. That was probably my first real introduction to the extent of the farm. We used to go up to Greenburn Lake once in a while to see the swans, which could be quite vicious. I remember being warned about the swans. You didn't want to get too close to them because they could attack you. I don't remember ever going to Brooks Point as a child, whereas Ruth's daughter, Kirsty, would go Brooks Point a lot to see the horses. Even John Smith lived right next door to Brooks Point, and they had horses. They'd run out there.
And then Gowland Point. In my era, we spent a lot of time in what we called the caves. There were holes in the rocks right up high on the point, and we could sit in there, hide, and we'd read books or we'd fish for cod down below.
Whereas the only time I'd go there is if my dad was fishing, which was probably when I was older. And I'm not sure why we didn't go around very much. You know, I'd spend a lot of time at my grandmother's. Usually when we arrived on the island, we go to my grandmother's right away. And my memories were sitting there petting her dog, Rufus, a little golden spaniel. Because I was so much younger than my parents. They were almost old enough to be my grandparents. And of course, my Granny Bee was quite old, maybe even 60 when I was a kid. And my mom grew up in kind of a Victorian era on Saturna because her grandmother was very Victorian. The time when children should be seen and not heard. And because I was such a little chatterbox, I would hear that quite often. So I'd sit there and pet the dog, or I got quite good at tending the fire because I love, you know, moving the logs just right so you get the right ventilation, get them going. The rest of the time, I just sit on the beach throwing rocks at logs, or there's that huge rock on the beach at Gowland Point, which is probably a glacial erratic, I imagine, because it's just an odd place. And that would be a tank or an airplane or a boat or something I could sit on top. And occasionally there'd be other kids around. John and Barb Pender would be around sometimes, although quite often holidays wouldn't quite coincide because the Penders would use our cabin if we weren't there. And also the John Henshaw's kids, Brad Henshaw and the girls, Shelley and Marnie, they'd all be down there. And the house Ruth was talking about, the Blue Tarpon, when I was young, Ann and Len Henshaw lived there for a while. And we'd have these great ball games with the huge plastic bat and the big plastic ball that kids could actually hit the ball. And the, you know, the adults would knock it a little further out than the kids, but at least the kids could knock it some distance. And Ann and Len Henshaw were wonderful. I remember as a child, and even my children would talk about them as, how old are they? They're like kids. Because they were so much fun. They were quite humorous, and they joked a lot, and they played a lot, and they weren't stuffy like a lot of the adults were.
And Ann and Lynn had been up at Britannia Beach. Lynn was with the mines up there, and then they moved down onto Pender. They were in Victoria for a while, and their son Dan was a very close friend of Joan Jan Jennings and myself. Dan went to UVic, but Ann and Lynn were, I knew them. Well, I used to stay with them on weekends when I moved down to Victoria in 1959 or 60, and I'd come over on weekends and stay with Ann and Lynn. And as you say, they were always so cheery, and we'd work together or have fun together.
And when I moved to the island, I was 17 when I left school, and I moved to Pender and lived down in the log cabin for a while. And Ann Henshaw had taken up watercolors and was a very good watercolorist and very interested in the arts. And she sent me over to meet a fellow, Tim Hume, who would have been, I was 17, Tim was in his mid-20s, I think. He lives in Salt Spring now. I haven't seen him since then, but at that time he had just finished showing some art at Expo in Japan, and Ann Henshaw said, "Kelly, you got," because she knew I was really interested in art. She said, "You got to go meet Tim." They were living in a cabin, I believe, now belongs to David Greer, just off the road down to Gowland. And so I went wandering over, woke them up. They were, you know, probably the first, you know, we call air parenthesis here, hippies, like real hippies I'd ever met. I mean, I was in high school and we were all growing our hair, trying to grow our hair, and depending on our parents. But anyway, I went over and met them, and they turned me on so many things, you know, as I guess looking for art influences. Tim showed me my first M.C. Escher, Salvador Dali, told me to read Dune, all things, and Lord of the Rings, all things that became very big in my life at that time. And that was kind of the era of, you know, when the first hippies were living on Pender. And it was kind of a fun time, just kind of crazy. I mean, and there was that kind of generational divide, I guess. But it was also because Pender is such a small community, it wasn't wasn't as maybe as divisive as it might be in a city where you'd get more of a reaction against long hairs. I remember, because I'd moved to the island when I was so young and came and went for a number of years. But I think that first go-round when I was living down there, there's a fellow living in the valley, an older fellow, and his nephew came up from the States to stay with him, and I met him, Charles, Chaz. And he had long hair and a big bushy beard, and it turned out he was a army deserter from America. He'd been to Vietnam once, and they wanted to send him back, and there was just no way he was going to be sent back. And, you know, I was still underage for drinking, but I guess because I was tall and had a bit of facial hair, they'd let me in the bar. And I remember going to the pub with Chaz one night, and they were just developing Magic Lake at the time. And there was a table of Magic Lake crew, and we sat down with them. For some reason, we sat down with these guys, and there's a few what we would call rednecks sitting there, and some kid from Idaho who was on the Magic Lake crew made some snarky comment to Chaz, and I don't know if he knew Chaz was an army deserter or if he's just being snarky, but this fellow pulled out a pocket knife and jammed it into the table, and he said, "Don't you talk about these guys that way. They're just regular people like you and me." And I was kind of sitting there open mouth, this redneck big farmer dude sticking up for us. And it was George Ross Smith. And turned out George was one that had the farm on North Pender, the big farm where the Wine family bought recently. And George was one of the first people who, like, openly welcomed hippies to come and live on his farm. And for years and years, so many people lived on that farm. And it was kind of wild that this big, rough farmer who had a farmer's red neck and was pretty tough looking welcomed us onto his farm. And people lived there and came and went. And he was quite open. I guess there was a time there, you know, different generations, like Ruth's generation and her summers on the island were quite a bit different than mine. And I lived on the island off and on when I was in my 20s and 30s and then moved back in the early 90s and have been here ever since.
I think my first memory of Kelly on the island, or what sticks out, is when you were christened at the Church of Good Shepherd. And Bishop Coleman was the minister in his robes with his running shoes on, his sneakers under his robes. And we were all chuckling in the background.
And I was terrified. I was howling. I think I was probably 6 or 7. Oh, yeah. It just scared the hell out of me.
But church had memories because Uncle Hubert, who was my great uncle, Hubert Payne, was the parson on Saturna. And then he would come over to the Church of Good Shepherd the odd time. And then he ended up in Victoria. And then I got married at St. Mary's in Oak Bay, where he was the minister. Yeah. But Bishop Coleman was quite the figure. And then here he was with his sneakers under his robes. So,
yeah, I was christened in that church and got married in that church. And
mm-hmm. I finished school in Kelowna and the family moved to Prince Rupert, and I wouldn't go there. It was raining too much. So I came down to Victoria. Then I started spending weekends coming over to Pender, and I'd stay with Ann and Len Henshaw. That's when Danny and I became quite good friends, Danny Henshaw, and I remember Dan picking me up at Port Wash with his motorbike, and we were coming up Scarves Hill, and it was so dusty, we got off the bike, it wouldn't make it up the hill, and we had to walk up the hill, and then we finally got down to Gallon Point. But I loved those weekends. We'd play cards, and I can remember going home on the bus back into Victoria with my shorts on, carrying a bucket of clams, and getting off the bus at the bay and then transferring with all these people wondering what the smell was on the bus. And it was the clams. And then later on, oh, and that's when Granny Bee was living at where Rob Dill is now. And it was quite a busy household at that time because her husband, John Freeman, was the mailman. So he would bring the mail up to that end of the island to the house, and then all the neighbors would come to the house and collect their mail. And Granny was always baking. I learned how to make scones from Granny Bee. And there were always stories being told. And there was always something going on, people dropping in and talk. And then, even when I was younger, when I was very young, we always met on the beach down below the log cabin at the end of the road there. And it was tea time, and people would collect on the beach, and we'd have tea and treats. But so many of us would sit with our hands going through the pebbles all the time, looking for agates. And I mean, the agates then were about the size of my fingernail. Many years later, I lived up north on Stewart Lake, and we found agates as big as my fist. So that was quite a revelation. Another memory going back in my earlier days, the ferry would come into Hope Bay. And at that time, Granny Bee and one of the Ochterlony ladies had a coffee shop down by the ferry dock. And Granny was living at Hope Bay at the time, married to Dick McGusty. And we would go to Corbett's store. That was the popular store then. And I always had my summer shoes bought at Corbett's store, a pair of sneakers, running shoes. And then if they were out of Macintosh toffee bars, I was allowed to go running down to the Princess Mary, the CPR boat, and buy a toffee bar at their coffee shop. And that's when I met Dave Ochterlony and his funny uncle, Louis Ochterlony, who was so great with all the kids in the neighborhood. I remember 1969, watching the landing on the moon up at Granny Bee and John's cottage house, and Kelly was sitting there drawing a cartoon of the astronauts saying, "How do I pee?" with the astronauts in their spacesuits. I remember that. At that time, my husband was on a job in Finland, and Kirsty and I were staying in the log cabin.
1969, I was my first year working at Bedwell. I was 15, and I worked in the store. And, I was living in the staff quarters, that's right, which are still there. And it was pretty wild because there was the boys' side and the girls' side, and most of the people working there were university age, university students. So I was by far and away the youngest. There was a lot of beer drinking. I think that was when I first started drinking beer. And it's when I first met a lot of local islanders. Well, Rob Story was working at Browning then, and Jim Allen. I think I met right around that time, Glenn Grimmer. And then August, the resort owners, instead of laying off the staff, they just fired about three quarters of the staff with very little notice. I remember they were all really upset because they thought they were working till school went back in, and all of a sudden they were losing 2 or 3 weeks of employment because I think it must have been a slow summer. And I was so outraged, I quit. And Mom and Dad were a little upset because here I was living in the staff quarters, and I quit, so I couldn't live in the staff quarters anymore. And I got Rob Story's job. Rob decided to quit at Browning, so I went to work at Browning for the last few weeks of the summer, which at that time was called Scott's Lair. And the owners had a son who played the bagpipes. And Rob played the trumpet. And every evening they would go down to the flagpole. And Rob would play taps or something. And they'd lower the flags. And then they'd go out in the dock. And I'm not sure if Rob played the drums or a snare drum. Because Mark, the owner's son, Mark Dennis, would play the bagpipes and they'd walk the docks, and it was a big thrill for the boaters. And then I went to work down there and they said, well, you gotta wear a kilt. And I just went, no way, I'm not wearing a kilt. And they finally got me to wear a kilt one day, and I didn't have any dress shoes, so I was wearing white sneakers with the kilt. That lasted a day, and then I wouldn't wear it again. And then I ended up working at Browning the next summer. So that was pretty cool because I stayed in my parents' cottage. My parents had bought a place on Browning just around the corner from the pub on Razor Point Road, corner of Razor Point and Pecos. So I could stay there and work over at Browning.
And that was the first house Mom and Dad had? They always rented, or when Dad became an officer in the RCMP, they force would lease them a house. And then he retired in 73, and it was Dave Octolone, and I can't remember who
Don
else.
Don Grimmer.
Right, that built the house at Browning for Mom and Dad. And there was a cottage beside it, which was great for the family for years, that we could come down and stay at the cottage.
And but, great for me, because I lived in it numerous times.
And Kelly, what year were you at Bedwell?
69, and then 70 I worked at Browning.
Because previous to that, my brother Rob, who's 12 years older than Kelly, 2 years younger than me, was working at Bedwell. And that was under the owners then were Bev Trump and Stan Lettner, who happened to be our old neighbors when we were living in Kelowna. And they opened up the resort. That was the first resort down at Bedwell, I believe.
Or a real big resort, destination resort, because mm-hmm. I think there were cabins there before.
Yeah, there were a few cabins, but they had the resort and the gas dock. And it was a destination for boaters. I came in quite often with friends on a boat if I was in the area. Well, Customs was there mm-hmm. and the gas dock. And then they had planes would fly in the odd time too and tie up, weren't they? Float planes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Previous to that, there were huge buoys anchored, like they were big barrels anchored out in the harbor where the Navy ships would come in. Now that was in the late 40s, early 50s. And when the Navy ships came in, that was quite something because the crews, they'd have baseball games up in the fields across from the fire hall. And Humes family, there was the mother and father and their son Larry lived up the hill then, and they would have a concession stand, and that was a big outing for the islanders. And that would have been the early, very early 50s. The Navy crew, they were very popular and got to know the islanders. And some of them would come up to Granny B's home or different islanders and do some maintenance work on their homes. And then Aunt Hope had her birthday party in August, mm-hmm. the end of August. And some of the crew would turn up at the birthday parties.
Yeah, I remember them being huge events when I was a kid because mm-hmm. I'd get to stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning, which was very unusual. And the house was huge, Aunt Hope's house, Aunt Hope and Uncle Jeff Jennings' house. It was a big, big log house, huge kitchen, dining area with a big living room next to it, looking out over the water. I don't know how many people would be there. Probably 100 or more people would be in the house for her birthday, including the Navy guys. And when I was a kid, say 7, 8, 9 years old, when we were living in Victoria, and I remember at least 2 of those parties, maybe even 3. And of course, the adults would be drinking more and more as the evening went on, and it'd just get crazier and crazier. And Art Pender would be playing his harmonica, somebody be playing the piano, people would be singing, dancing. I remember my Uncle Jeff grabbing me one night and spinning me around till I just about got sick flying through the air. But it'd go on till the wee hours of the morning, and it was, I'd never stay up late that late. Otherwise, we'd get back to cabin, which was just over the hill around 3 in the morning. And Bedwall, of course, there was the post office there. Granny Spaulding was the postmistress in the early years. So there was a post office, and the steamships would come in there. And my dad, in his memoirs, wrote about when he was a kid going down to collect the mail with his mother, my Granny B. And there was all mag weapons fire from over across the harbor from Wallace Point. And that was a popular drop-off spot for rum runners. They come over from the States, and they're the narrow coves that run in there. So it'd be easy to blast across the border, duck into one of these coves, drop a load, and then take off. And then the Canadian guys would pick it up from there. Or I guess the Canadian guys were dropping it off there. The Americans come over and pick it up. And what had happened was two bootleggers had appeared at the same time, were having it out, one with an automatic weapon. I think Dad said he went over there afterwards to see if there was anything to be found. And he told me years later, he said, you know, for years and years, we believed there was a rum cache somewhere on South Pender that had been lost, and he and Art would go exploring, looking for it, trying to find the lost rum. It was like gold, lost gold in hills somewhere. And those rum runners, the Americans anyway, they put Rolls-Royce airplane engines in their boats, and they were screamingly fast. Mm-hmm. Quite a trade.
Yeah, because there have been many stories written about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then in later years, it became pot. They dropped bales of pot off Bedwall or Browning. I remember when I was probably in my mid-20s, a bale broke apart in Browning, and the beach was covered in pot. Yeah, Bedwall Harbor, when I worked there, 69, and probably a few years before that, because they had it since the late 50s, the Trumps.
And, oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was 53 or 4.
Yeah, so it was quite developed when I worked there. It was part of a network, a chain of resorts. And people like, well, because the customs was there, the customs dock, and then other nearest customs dock would have been Salt Spring. So John Wayne would come in on his boat. I never saw him myself, but I know, because I wasn't on the docks, but I know a lot of people did see him.
And I know other Americans that came up were the Kaisers from Washington State, and they would have maybe 3 boats, a trawler and a speedboat, and anyway, 3 or 4, and they'd come through, and everybody was quite intrigued with their boats, and then they were heading up north. Up to Desolation or towards Alaska. Yeah.
And there was the pub there. So it was party time on the boats and in the pub. I remember going down the docks, being invited on boats for a beer. It's pretty common. I got jerked off the dock once by a boater who threw me his line and then hit reverse and backed up suddenly and pulled me into the water. Not all the boaters should be in boats, I think. I mean, Bedwall has a history of strange and bad accidents, people crashing through docks and people hitting the seaplanes. And I remember years later, some woman running down the dock, I think it was the dock or the pool, stubbing her toe in a knot hole and having serious damage. It was almost cursed. And of course, it burned down in the late 70s, I think, because it was after I had my wedding reception there. It was still the old bed wall, and it burned down. That was a huge story. A friend of mine's brother-in-law had his boat on the dock, and they'd actually told everybody to leave the docks. I think it was Halloween. It was the Halloween weekend. They'd had the big annual Halloween party, and then the next day or the day after, they say, okay, we're closing everybody off the docks. But this fellow had to stay. He had a sailboat, and the weather wasn't conducive to sailing away. So he stayed on the docks, and he got up in the morning, he noticed smoke coming out of the around the dining area. So he ran up to the payphone and phoned it into the fire department. And it hit the propane tanks fairly quickly, I think. So they blew up, and they managed to salvage a bit, but pretty much toasted the dock. And of course, there were rumors and stories of maybe it wasn't an accident. I don't think anything was ever proven, but there were some very suspicious characters hanging around at the time. Yeah, our family members, I don't think, were very involved. But I knew people who worked at Bedwell and said that there's some odd characters hanging around that night. And then, of course, you know, over the years, it's been rebuilt and torn down and rebuilt again. And then, of course, they uprooted the, because there was a village site there for the Wasanich. And they dug up a lot of bones. And, you know, it was just some kind of bad vibes off and on.
Pardon me, that was a problem too at one time, wasn't it? With Bedwell Harbor and the reserve, there was a beach there, and then there used to be the beach right in front of Bedwell, the clamshell beach, and then that became a problem later on when they rebuilt, I think, because of the artifacts, the archaeological facts
that was
there.
That was a big issue. I believe they had to pay fines on that. Yeah, Hay Point. When I was young, we used to party at Hay Point, the reserve land, because mm-hmm. it was right next to Bedwell. I believe there are probably generations of parties on that point.
Yeah, because we used to picnic there.
Mm-hmm. Whereas now, I've been there for land restoration projects with the Pender Conservancy and the Wasanich Tribal School and elders. Yeah, it's wonderful what's happening there and the relationship that's being rebuilt. Because when our parents and grandparents, great-grandparents, you know, they grew up with and had interaction with the local Indigenous people from Saanich and from Cowichan and even Tawassan, you know, they'd come over and from Up Island too. And I've talked to people who remember meeting Spaldings when they'd come over and do clam digs, and they would meet Dave Spalding or Herb Spalding or my Granny B, and there'd be an exchange of food. And when I was young, that really didn't happen. By the time I was, I remember my dad taking me meet Chief Underwood, because he said, you got to meet this fellow because you're living on South Pender, and you know. My dad taught me respect for Native people from quite an early age, because I was a fan of the Lone Ranger. And he said, you know, TV westerns and movies are very inaccurate. And so he told me what was really going on. And so when I was a teenager and moved to the island, he said, well, I'm going to take you and meet Chief Underwood. But after that, I never really met any of the local Indigenous people. They just didn't come over that much because their reef fishing was banned. So they weren't reef fishing. They would do a bit of clam digging. I remember occasionally seeing them collecting seaweed, sea lettuce. I lived at Roseland for a while, for one winter, mid-70s. And I remember them coming over and collecting sea lettuce off the beach. Or you'd see them clam digging at the canal. And my dad would meet them quite often because my dad and my Uncle Herb would be down there looking for artifacts on the beach. And then, like Ruth was mentioning, Simon Fraser University came over and did a dig. And my dad and Uncle Herb would be down there a lot.
I remember in probably 1982 or 3, being at the canal with Dad and talking to some of the Simon Fraser University people. And Dad's talking away, and all of a sudden he bends down and picks something up. And it was a librette, an artifact. And the Simon Fraser student was quite surprised. Dad had just bent over, picked it up, and said, "Well, here you go."
You develop an eye for those things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, I know people today, a few people on the island can just walk along the beach and spot these things almost instantaneously. And I think that's part of island life. You grow up around here, you spend a lot of time beach combing, and there's a lot of middens on the island.
Yeah.
And people tend to forget that, you know, people lived here and fished and hunted here for thousands of years. The farm on North Pender, the Ross Smith and now Wine Farm, that used to be a beachfront at one time. And when Victor Menzies was, I think, the first farmer on that land, he found all kinds of artifacts when he's plowing up the field, because thousands of years ago, there was a village site there. Yeah, I think because the island's so covered in greenery, there's a lot of things we just don't know about or we miss because trees are growing over them. Or
going back to Bedwell Harbor, when I was very young, we were staying in the White Cottage, as we knew it, down on the beach. And I had put a night line out on the wharf. And the next morning I went out and I couldn't pull it up. And so Dad and I went out in the dinghy with our dog, a big Irish setter, and we thought it was that the line was wound around the piling, but it was all of a sudden an octopus came up out of the water, and our dog jumped into the water and swam to shore, and we pulled the octopus in. I've got pictures. We measured it, and I think it was 6 feet across, and then we said, well, it was too bad we didn't know any Japanese neighbors at the time where they were eating octopus. There were some on Main Island, but anyway, we threw it back in the water. It was the summer before we had the log cabin, so it was the mid-40s, no doubt. We were staying up at Browning Harbor then, and Dad's good friend Lyle Brackett had a home there with his mother. And we had gone fishing. Lyle had a boat with a motor in it, and we were off of Monarch Head, and Lyle had just bought a new fishing rod, and I caught the first fish on it, and it was a salmon, a big salmon. I don't know how much it weighed, but I was quite thrilled with it. But in those days, we used to row all the time. I loved the water. We were always on the water if we weren't running up a hill somewhere. But we would row down to Tilly Point, and that had quite a current, and over to Blunden Island, and we'd always have a hand line. And then right on the beach below Gower Point, we could just throw a line in. I remember in the evening, we would throw a line in from the beach and catch rock cod, and that was in the early days in the 40s.
Whereas I hated fishing. It was so boring. Lyle Brackett, we'd go out with Lyle Brackett or Granny B's husband, John Freeman. And the motor would stink, you know, an old stinky motor. And it'd take forever to get out there. And then they'd slowly go back and forth along the shore, back and forth. And you're lucky if you caught a fish.
But then I was fortunate because Mum's father and my grandparents that lived in Deep Cove on Mum's side had a boat, the Sea Thrift, and Mum and Dad were allowed to use it the odd summer. And so we could get around the islands in that. They had come from Saturna and retired over in Deep Cove off of Sydney area. And when Dad was building the log cabin, Daryl Georgeson was running a boat through the islands at the time, and that was such a treat. It was, it would be like not a fish boat, but the size of a small trawler. And he had a dog, and we loved going with Daryl. And he took us into Sydney for building supplies at the time. Mitchell and Anderson had a lumber company right on the shores of the Port of Sydney. And Daryl was very well known, an old family on the islands, the Georgeson family. But that was his profession, running around from island to island, taxing people and cargo. And
what I really miss would be the when inter-island traffic was free. You could go between islands for free in the 70s. I still have my Gulf Islands residence card that you would show so you could get your free inter-island travel. Because in the very old, the original pioneering days, the islanders would go back and forth, yeah, rowing or sailing or putting along. And then, with the ferry system and having to pay and then the ferry schedule, I mean, now to go to Salt Spring, as you know, is really difficult. But when I was living here in the 70s, my second daughter was born on Salt Spring because it was so easy to go to the doctor on Salt Spring or to go grocery shopping on Salt Spring because you could get food there you couldn't get on the island. And now the islands are so isolated from one another, it's really too bad, that sense of inter-island community.
When I retired from my government job in Victoria in 2002, I had bought an acre on Castle Road on South Pender Island, and I had my dream house built, a two-story house up on a knoll looking down on the valley that my grandfather Spalding had pioneered. And I thought I would be there for the rest of my life. And I got to know a lot of the neighbors. And at that time, Anne Henshaw had passed away, but Len was still on the island. And then he passed away. But John Henshaw was keeping an eye on the contractors building my house. And then I moved in and I started making a garden. And then Ronnie Henshaw came up with his excavator and extended the mound that the house was built on, the knoll. So I had lots of parking space. And I got to know people very well, some of my neighbors. I was in the exercise class at the fire hall, and I was doing Meals on Wheels that was running out of the driftwood. And one of the highlights was the bird count. I think it was Christmas time. It was in December. And I would do that with John Henshaw through the valley. Anyway, I really enjoyed my time, and I would have stayed there for the rest of my life, except my daughter, Kirsty, and son-in-law, Judd, had a baby, Lena. So I went back to Sydney so I could be there for Lena growing up. And I was only in the house for 2.5 years. And I really enjoyed meeting the fellows that were building it and keeping an eye on it. And I do miss the island. I miss the house. But I will end up in Sydney for the rest of my years. Mm-hmm.
I think Pender feels, or at some point in my life, Pender felt like home. I know for sure when I was finishing university, I came over. Now, I went to university as a mature student. I went to UVic, so I would have been in my late 30s. And I came to work for Salish Construction one summer 92, and I pretty certain I remember being on the boat coming into Otter Bay and going, Pender is home. I just want to stay here. Because before I'd come and gone, I moved here in 71 for a year, and then I was here in the mid-70s for a couple years working for Pender Island Lumber and Freight. And I'd stay for a few months, sometimes a year or two. And it was always a question of work, having steady work. Or as I had a family and needed to work more and more, or just, you know, school, stuff like that. So I was away from the island for probably almost 10 years at one point where I wasn't living here. But when I came back in 92, I just went, this is home. And I think part of that was because with Dad being in the RCMP, we were moving every couple of years anyway. I went to 12 or 13 schools before I graduated.
And that's where Kelly and I differ. I had two schools, Maple Ridge and Kelowna. Poor Kelly was from BC to Alberta to Manitoba and back.
Yeah, back and forth. And so I came in the early 90s. Since it's been like what now over 30 years I've lived here, and I love the community. I love the nature here. I do get a little tired, especially as I'm getting older now, the humidity and the cold in the winter. I can see why people, I just got back from the American Southwest, and I can see why people go there in the winter because it's nice and warm and dry. But I think the community on Pender's pretty special, and the islands, the Gulf Islands as a community, it's a pretty special ecosystem. And I really like what's happening with the connections with the Wasanic and other Indigenous people in this area, the connections that are being rebuilt, and people acknowledging that, you know, like my family's been here four or five generations, but, you know, there are people been living here for thousands of years who really had roots here. Now people are acknowledging that maybe, you know, they knew how to take care of the land. And you know, I guess as I get older, I, you know, remember, like a lot of people getting older, you start remembering things from your past and less of what's going on right now. I've got a terrible short-term memory. But I was having a conversation with a friend recently, and he reminded me of, we had this, it's kind of a joke. It was a joke organization called SPILL, S-P-I-L-L, South Pender Island Liberation Army. It was dreamt up over a bunch of beers and probably a little bit of pot. Can't remember the exact circumstances. I remember vaguely some of the people who were there. It wasn't all just youngsters like myself. It was kind of a mixed crowd of people enjoying beers. And started joking around about liberating South Pender from North Pender. I guess Magic Lake had been developed, and we didn't want to see kind of that big subdivision aesthetic coming to South Pender. So we thought, well, we'll liberate South Pender from North Pender. And of course, the only way you can liberate it is take the bridge out. And one of the group had some experience with dynamite and such. So we talked about that. And that progressed to the Bedwell Harbor Resort, which we, I don't know what the word would be. I guess we disapproved of it. It was blight on the landscape. I mean, it was a jolly place, and we all went there to drink beer, and it was open in the winter and provided groceries and this and that. But there was some dissatisfaction with the place. And this fellow who had experience with dynamite said, well, you know, there's one main beam under the dining room, which at that point was up on the hillside above the pub, which was right on the edge of the beach. And he said, you know, if we took out that beam, the whole dining room would slide down the hill and take out the pub, and that would essentially be it for Bedwell. And this was an ongoing joke. And at some point, some folks in Vancouver who were friends of friends had a silkscreen operation going, and they made us up bumper stickers that just simply said SPILL, the letters S-P-I-L-L, nothing else. And so a bunch of us all had these bumper stickers, and I guess word was getting around, and I was 17 at the time, and I could go to the bar, and they told me I couldn't go to the bar anymore at Bedwell. They said, nope, you're not welcome here anymore. We heard about you, planning to blow the place up. And I just went, okay, fine. You know, I guess I'm underage anyway. I shouldn't really be here. They knew that too, because I'd worked there when I was 15, so they darn well knew how old I was. And it was just a joke, and it just got taken the wrong way. And it's funny how that is, and how people's attitudes, people will pick up on things like that and hold it against you. And I was lucky because my dad was from the island, my mom from Sterna, and I had a heritage on Pender, so family heritage, and people would hire me or give me a home because of that. And I guess they would look past the long hair and the scruffiness and the unbathedness of me when I was living in my dad's log cabin, and they would give me a job. I worked for Alan Brooks for a long time and did his gardening, and my dad's cousin, John Spalding, gave me a job working for Spalding Sanitary Services, running around his truck. And he would bug me about my hair and call me Goldilocks, but it was all a big joke. And it was a great job. We just scuttled around the island. It was 1958, I think it was, International. And those same people that created our bumper sticker for Spill created him a fantastic calendar of a polarized photo of he and his wife Marilyn and their garbage truck, and made this really hip looking calendar, and it hung on his wall for years and years. I believe it's still in the house, the Spalding, the big house they call it down the Spalding property. And so I think I was accepted just because of my family, and it just really would annoy me that people would come down on other people just because they had long hair or were scruffy. I continue to see that today, and in that people will talk about all the dirty kids or the scruffy kids or the kids with their dyed hair or their funny haircuts or whatever, and they'll put them down, and I'll just turn around and I'll say, hey, look, man, these are the people that cut your lawns and dig your ditches because you can't do it, and no one else is willing to do it. And if it wasn't for them, who would do it? And on one hand, you welcome them to your home to do your dirty work. And on the other hand, you'll turn around and criticize them. They're just young people who love the island for whatever reason and looking for some work to get by. It's, they could be living in the city, but they're not. They're here on Pender, and they're hanging in there. So the whole problem with affordable housing that bothers me, that there's no housing for the workers on this island, when you see so many people coming from Vancouver Island to do work, because there just isn't housing here for the workers. And you end up with a whole bunch of kids living in one house because they can't find houses, or living in their parents' trailer or whatever. And the way Pender's becoming South Pender and Pender in general, it's the same old story. It's no longer rural. It's becoming, and I divide the two words, suburban. It's like divided up, clear cut, messed up. And then, they turn around and sell their property and it's a mess, and somebody comes along and has to replant it and restore it. I read so many stories in newspapers about people saying how good it is to get out and bathe in the forest or swim in the ocean. These are all things that make us healthy and happy, and yet people come over here and they want to look like the prairies. They just want to get rid of the trees so they have a view. This is Pender. This is nature. It's the way it goes, and go with it. So, as somebody who's spent a long time in Pender and whose family is from Pender and seen it over the years, I have pretty deep feelings about that. And sometimes I get really annoyed about it. And I'm trying to learn to be a little more patient, a little more meditative, and just no more chill about it, I guess, not be so angry about it. Maybe I should read my great-grandfather Arthur Spaulding's poem, which I think really sums up my kind of beliefs too, although I didn't come here from England, but he came from Sussex, was it? Do you remember, Ruth, where he came from? The Spaulding family had a paper mill in England. Of course, Lilius's roots went far deeper. Her dad and that side of the family go back to Swampy Cree in northern Quebec. So her feelings were probably even stronger. But this is, Arthur loved writing rhyme, and my Granny Bee loved writing rhyme, and my dad, and even I occasionally write a little poetry. So something that goes on in the family. So this is from A Gulf Islands Patchwork, which our grandmother B. Spaulding edited, put together in early 60s, 61, mm-hmm. I think. And this is written by Arthur Spaulding in 1880-something, 1888, I think it says. The Hermit. I'm a recluse, as certain people term it. In other words, a sort of budding hermit. In a lone island, midst Pacific waters. I shun the sons of man, still more their daughters, in simple majesty and quiet ease. Hemmed in by water and again by trees, I live as lived the holy men of old, far from all worldly cares and thoughts of gold. Such duties as recur from day to day, to find that hog, to give the oxen hay, with fearful oath to drive the team afield, to swing the axe, which none but I can wield, to kill the sheep when pangs of hunger seize, such modern duties only serve to please. Perchance you'll say a hermit nowadays scores next to nothing, scarcely praise. The days are gone for monks and holy brothers, and hermits may be damned as well as others. Granted, you're right, and settling that aside, on creature comfort will the case decide. No starchy cuffs, no stuck-up collar's eye, no studs to fasten, no confounded tie, a hat that's some the worse for being crushed, clothes which improve by never being brushed, boots which never felt the bootblack's skill, and which I wear or do not wear at will. No calls to pay, no parties to attend, no money in my purse, so none to lend. No church to go to, no confounded tribe of parsons with their watchword, please subscribe. No one to say, oh, Arthur, what a mess. What ragged knickerbockers, how you dress. Supposing Mrs. So-and-so should call. And are you really smoking in the hall? Past are those troubles, far from social strife. The hermit cottons to his lonely life. Pals of my youth, it's possible that ye, when stuck for what to think of me. And in your pleasing manner wonder how the deuce old Spaulding likes his life there now. Spare me your pity and believe it's true, you wretched beggars, that I pity you.
Island life. I think he liked being a hermit, because I remember Granny Spaulding went down to California and stayed quite a long time for a little trip. And then I remember meeting the great aunts who had a place up near Castle Road, going up to Castle Road, the old aunt's place, and then they moved up to Duncan.
And Ruth knows that I keep up the hermit thing, because when she lived on South Pender, I think we visited twice. She would phone and say, why don't you come on down? I'd go, oh, it's such so a far. Long drive. It's across the bridge.
Yeah.
Thank you very much to Kelly and Ruth for doing this interview. This interview and the entire series has been made possible with funding from the Capital Regional District, the Pender Island Community Resource Center, the Wasanich Leadership Council, Wasanich School Board, the Pender Islands Museum, and the South Pender Historical Society. Thank you to all these organizations for contributing to make these recordings possible.